Hello, everybody. I continue to be John Atack, and this is my friend, Dr. Nick Charles. And we've known each other, what, about 7 years now. Not that we've had enough contact, I don't think, in that time. And tell us something about your background and why we should bother to listen to you.
Okay.
No, you don't have to tell us that. I know why we should.
Well, no, you should always check for authenticity so that you know you can trust somebody.
Yeah,
so I'm a retired child and family psychiatrist. I had a career here in Scotland. I live in Edinburgh, trained in Edinburgh. And so the high points of my journey were, after a while, I thought I'd been trained in depression, but not in life or joy. And I thought that meant I knew how to crash planes, but not fly them or help other people.
Good way to put it.
So that then led me on to reading more widely than my professional background. Families led me to other ways of thinking about it, systems, other agencies, and so on. So I retired to be a family therapist for a while in a voluntary organization. And there I came across, belatedly and shamefully, the strife of many separated families and their children, and extreme strife, forms of coercive control and abuse. So I then thought, why haven't we thought about this before? Why has this not been really made my business? Because it was disturbed children and parents, disturbed by or disturbed before the troubles that they were going through. So then for 10 years, and when we last spoke, I was in those 10 years, I was trying to make sense of it. And I wrote a blog, which you can still find, is called the alienationexperience.org.uk. And on it, you'll find that I made a lot of value out of comparing kind of coercive conflictual relationships in families and coercive difficult relationships in cults. So I thought there was a lot in common. It's not completely in common, because there are differences that need to be attended to, but you'll see there I made a lot of that subject. And I, for example, developed a questionnaire worded in such a way that it could be applied to those in cults or coming out of cults and those who were in families. Of course, when you're in a coercive relationship in a cult, you may not know. In fact, you may think you're as happy as you've ever been before. Perhaps not in a family, but in a cult you can be. Anyway, after a while, I thought this is not working, because we're just ending up in continuing polarized battles, mainly gender versus gender. People who are focused quite understandably on domestic violence, domestic abuse, that kind of coercive control, and those that were focusing on coercive control that cut children off from their loving parents without due cause. And so I eventually decided, I found out about how, you know, what sort of campaign would be required to basically change the culture, change it in a way that reminded us all of what we already know. It's not like an unknown thing. It's that children and parents and families and carers and those who love them kind of belong to each other, not only when they're being brought up, but even for life.
Yes.
So the organization I've been involved with for the last 2 or 3 years is dedicated to transforming the way we think about separating families, think and deal with them. And that's a long-term project. And so I became aware that I was an amateur campaigner. So I had to learn about campaigning for the first time in my life. And one of the things I hope we'll talk about is applying prevention to cults. So that would be one of the topics. And the organization I work for is called Two Wishes Foundation. You can just Google Two Wishes and you'll find it. Or twowishes.org is our busy magazine kind of website. Is that enough?
That's pretty good. Yeah. And the other conversation that we had on the channel here was about alienation, and I talk far too much, and I apologize for that. It's habitual, I'm afraid.
Okay.
Because I've been married twice, had two children in each relationship, and recognize this as something that goes on. And it is one of it's a bane of our society that people will, you know, get together, have children, fall out, and then one or both will take issue with the other parent and make life a misery for their children. Fundamentally, that's what I've seen, and for one another often. And it does go over into coercive control. Margaret Singer, she became interested in work with what we call cult groups, dangerous cult groups, because she'd worked with Edgar Schein with returning prisoners of war from North Korea, who'd so-called been brainwashed. And she said, oh, these are very like the victims of domestic abuse, the way these men behave. And so she started to make that comparison back in the early 60s.
What direction.
Yeah. And for me, in looking at Scientology and then other dangerous authoritarian groups, it became apparent that we were dealing with the same dynamics, with the same psychology. And so that you and I met through the Open Minds Foundation some time ago. And I think that was because you'd had perhaps a client, but somebody you were talking to who'd suggested to you that perhaps psychiatry was a cult, that, you know, perhaps the, and it, my understanding from our conversations is, let me say something here that's specific to our ex-Scientologist audience. One of the ideas in Scientology put forward by Ron Hubbard is that all psychiatrists, psychologists, and psychotherapists belong to a conspiracy that is trying to destroy everything good in the universe. And it reminds me of the notion, you know, if you have two rabbis in a room, you'll have three opinions. And that's certainly my experience of, you know, psychotherapists, psychiatrists. But what impressed me about you from the beginning was that you are something of a maverick. You were not somebody who just accepted these are the rules and I'm going to play by them. You questioned the rules and you've continued to do that. And what you're saying about, you know, prevention and cure, that we both worked on the recovery, the cure end of things. And, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a ton of cure, as far as I'm concerned, that if we can do something to change the perception, and as you say, bring about the things that we know, but we're not working with, you know, to bring things into consciousness, so that people understand there is such a thing as coercive control, there is such a thing as an authoritarian or abusive relationship, and it doesn't have to be that way. We can make a better society, I strenuously believe, or I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing at all. And so tell us more about Two Wishes. And
okay. So as I say, Two Wishes is, I would say, because of my colleagues in that organization, it is informed by professional campaigning skills. So we're talking about culture change in the long term. And instead of the kind of downstream where people are just drowning and being dragged out, just to say a bit more about that the dominant culture all around the world, pretty much, of where you're meant to go when you separate and have difficulties is family law. So family law is doing its very best, but it's the wrong system when you think you've already got conflict and already got adversarial relationships going and kids in the middle who don't know what's going on or don't know whose side to take. You've got an inherently adversarial solution to this. Yeah. So in a sense, that's what we need to do, is to change that. And the other thing you said that reminded me is often the parents are seen as sort of disturbed or stupid to be having this fight, when actually most people will know somebody and will know that it's very distressing. It's the most probably, you know, one of the most distressing things to happen. So that what you need is, as you have with any other situation like grief or illness in the family, you need to have a supportive, compassionate approach to it. And you need to have often skilled services, because it can become really fraught and difficult. And there are risks, and you do have to have skilled services to make sure the risks are contained while people settle down and hopefully repair the damage in their relationships. So Two Wishes is about trying to say, can we please think how to think more compassionately about separating families, and how can we promote the services that are much more upstream than family lawyers? And I used to call it, I'm still talking about upstream, downstream, but that doesn't really allow for the full strength of what Two Wishes and other culture changing campaigns do. In a sense, the metaphor is about a river, and it is very difficult to imagine a river changing direction. So everybody is struggling to swim upstream and failing because the river is a torrent. So what you need for a culture change is the one I use is prevailing wind. So the prevailing wind is in this direction. And then everybody's trying to fight into the wind and failing because they're all individuals, they're amateurs, they're distressed, they are on their own usually, or just in small groups. They've all got a website, they've all got a name for their campaign, they've all got a silver bullet that's going to solve everything. It's just not going to, it hasn't worked anyway. So what you need to do is think of it as the prevailing wind changes, because that's just about imaginable. When the prevailing wind changes, then everybody is blown in the right direction, and everybody's efforts are going to be much, much easier. So Two Wishes is about changing the direction of the prevailing wind in around the world. It's an international organization to change cultures so that everybody's blown in the right direction, which is towards an early compassionate approach to separating parents.
The focus
is on the children, because if you don't focus on the children, all you do is play back into which parent is good, which parent is bad, who's to blame.
Yeah, and you have a binary system, a polarized situation that will continue from there. And of course, incredible cultural change has taken place. A lot of people, many people I've spoken with, have lost heart with our culture. We'll publicly talk about how they are changing things and benefit is coming about, but privately, they're completely at a loss. They're not optimistic. They're not hopeful. And I think, there is that overwhelming sense that, the environmental degradation is going to go on a pace. China is going to start a war with America, or, whatever is, Ukraine and Russia, whatever is going to happen. And I think it's very important to look back and say, human society has transformed so much, most especially in the richer and greedier part of the world. But the thought that, in the 1860s, 4 and 5 year old children were being pushed up chimneys to clean them. And if they got stuck, they were left there and they were going down mines. And you say, well, this can't possibly have happened. Yes, it did. And that's changed. Our attitude towards slavery has changed, though sadly, of course, there are more slaves, about 40 million, the United Nations reckons, 13 million of them in India. And I wonder about that. We stopped buying things from South Africa because 38 blacks were killed in detention. We didn't stop dealing with Australia, where 180 blacks were killed in detention in the same period. But 13 million slaves, there should be something that we could do about that. But I think it's very important. I think our culture is becoming more considerate and more moral. And as long as we can keep feeding everybody, that can continue apace, hopefully. And I'm talking with a guy who is working on, he's working with Andy Lee and World Coalition of Mental Health, I think they call themselves. And his objective is for the United Nations to adopt the principle of freedom of mind as a human right, not freedom of thought, freedom of mind. And he's a very smart guy. And I get where he's going, you know, that he's seen that there's this missing element that we do have the right to our own minds. And we live in a world where that's being exploited on a daily basis by advertisers, spin doctors, and, of course, authoritarian cult groups of various kinds. So for me, the putting the idea into the culture, people thinking about and discussing the idea, and people sort of realizing, yes, this is the right idea. You know, I'm, as you know, I've written about human predators, taking what he's said about psychopaths, sociopaths, narcissists, you know, the various and many categories that we have, antisocial personalities, and trying to extract from that and say, well, there are certain behaviors that people have, and we need to recognize these things and not let them become politicians. And, you know, I've just watched this awful documentary called House of Maxwell, which is not actually about the coffee brand. It's about the Robert Maxwell and Ghislaine Maxwell. And realizing that this man, Robert Maxwell, was the most dreadful predator. Quite evidently, I didn't know he was actually an agent for the KGB at the same time that he was an agent for MI6. And I don't think he bothered to tell either group, you know, very much eye on the main chance. But recognizing such people and then not, you know, throwing them, you know, building a colony in Australia or something to send them all to, but actually trying to integrate and understand, not giving them positions of power and compassionately doing whatever we can to restrict them. With somebody like Ted Bundy, that means locking them up. But by bringing that idea, by saying, you know, and we both know Ira Chaloff's work with intelligent disobedience and courageous followership, and these ideas are taking on like wildfire. I talked with Ira a couple of months ago, and somebody had approached him from the civilian arm of the US military to say, oh, we'd like to study your courageous followership. And he said, you do know that the US military are already using it. And there are 300,000 people in the civilian arm. He's also been approached by Toyota in the US. And so this idea of, and the difference is that in the army, in the US military, you're not meant to do anything that violates law. You can refuse an order that breaks the law. And now they're saying you shouldn't do anything that violates morality. And that's a serious shift in thinking. So, I mean, that's just to say that such cultural change can and does happen, and it's the most wonderful thing about human beings, that we can get better. We can do things better. We seem to be caught up in a rush of consumerism and technology at the moment, which is causing some problems. But
okay, so let me take a few things and put them together, and if I can. So going to back to psychiatry, I don't think I've ever thought of psychiatry as a cult. I've seen it as a limited way of working with problems. So there's I'm a doctor originally, so I believe in medicine, if you like, a medical model, and that's a really good model of practical science, where you actually think carefully, what's the symptoms, what might be the possible differential diagnosis, what should we test, what's the final view as to what's going wrong and what's the treatment. So, you know, this is a problem-solving approach which only engineers usually use so carefully. So I would say psychiatry certainly is a valid way of approaching problems, and often there is a medical aspect to it that needs to be assessed as part of a multidisciplinary team usually. So that's to say I believe in science and critical thinking as one of the discoveries since Enlightenment of how to ensure your own freedom of mind and other people's freedom of mind. Somewhere in there is working between, you know, what's reality, reality objectively, and what is subjective feelings, views, and so on. So I'm glad to hear what you're telling me about. It's not a surprise that with the internet, one of the good things about the internet, presumably, will be the support that you get when you're otherwise isolated in your own difficult situations of various kinds, including cults and coercion. And also the resources you get relatively privately. It'd be hard to stop people now finding alternative views. What I have found, though, myself, is a different sort of picture going alongside, which I don't think you'll disagree with, is the same internet can be a source of almost unwitting. Nobody's initially designing the internet and social media to be damaging. But you do have now the capacity to, in a sense, somebody decides science is white patriarchal rubbish. And so lived experience is important. Well, lived experience is important, but it's also important to put that alongside scientific evidence about, well, how many people have this lived experience and so on. So to my mind, we're still struggling to hold on to reason and evidence and to drive campaigns that also hold on to reason and evidence because it's really easy to lose the plot and to find ourselves in so many ways in polarized ideological fights, and people in the middle who are trying to think critically and have a conversation about these issues, many of them, politics, race, gender, sexuality, violence, abuse, you know, you'll find people across, you know, from left to right, usually is how it's portrayed. And it's in social media anyway, it's almost impossible to have a discussion. It's like you, as soon as you want a discussion, you must be on the other side because you don't fully agree with my polarized view. So, and it seems to me one of the things I was trying to think about before today was, you know, when does a social media bubble of thinking, you know, you Facebook sends you what you like, Twitter sends you what you like, you then the think it's the same as you. Yeah. It's almost unwitting. People also maneuver it and pull levers to make sure that also happens and create fake news. But even without that, you can be in a bubble. And when does that bubble become something more cultic, like QAnon and so on? And I think you have, it's important then to come back and look at old discussion about religion and cults, because there, in a sense, religions are daft as well. You know, I'm reading a book by Yuval Noah Harari, Homo Deus, after his Sapiens book, and he's saying the whole superpower of the human race for 70,000 years has been the capacity to create a fiction and make it persuasive of a few or many, many others in order that the human tribe or nation or army can be very powerful and unstoppable where the individual human being can't be. So he's saying everything, even money, organizations, corporations, politics, you name it, religions, these are all fictions. But the difference between a fiction, a religion, let's say, that is not cultic and one that is the simple thing that I made my strap line for the alienation experience is relationships that take you in and cut you off. So to me, there's the two features, which if you see them, then even though it's still a religion and there's shame and, you know, nasty consequences if you break ranks. If you are essentially allowed or possibly even encouraged to think for yourself and look at other resources and other ways and other religions and other critical thinking, then that isn't the kind of controlling, coercive relationship that a cult or a coercive family
is. I mean, I've come down to the notion of authoritarianism, and a number of people, you know, who've worked around cults, we're moving to that and saying, well, whether it's a cult or not, you know, give me a definition. You know, what on earth do you mean by that? Because certainly nobody's using the dictionary definition.
No.
So the problem for me is one of authoritarianism, where you have people who believe themselves to be absolutely brilliant, and everything they say must go. That's the one end of it, the Hitlers, the strong men, and strong women as well at times. And that they feel infallible. And then you have possibly the majority of humanity who are going, well, I don't know enough about this. My opinion isn't important. This person seems certain. They seem to know what they're talking about. I'll follow them. And they put their faith in that person, and then are drawn on often to truly dreadful consequences. I think that the boundary line for a dangerous group is where it refuses freedom of association and it refuses freedom of thought. So, you know, when Christians tell me how important faith is, I point out the story of Doubting Thomas, that if Jesus was willing to accept this guy didn't recognize him, having spent a couple of years in his company, it was okay for him to put his fingers in the holes to make sure it was him. And so that there is this idea of actually it's all right to have evidence. The Dalai Lama, and you know, I have mixed feelings about the Dalai Lama, but he is a clever bloke. And he said that if he found that any principle of Buddhism was scientifically unsound, he would reject it. And that caused a furore in the Buddhist community. Of course, you've got to accept what the Buddha said. And then you go, well, actually, the Buddha said, don't trust anything until you've checked it for yourself. It's the Kalama Sutta, in fact. So you get this situation where people become believers and they take on a faith and they, you know, and off they go with, you know, as Robert J. Lifton points out, the demand for purity. They now must become, you know, we don't eat cabbages, or, you know, we never talk to people. And reflecting on this sort of, for me, the most straightforward demonstration of this polarized world that the internet has helped to create, the World Wide Web has helped to create. A year or so back, I saw a protest in an American city, I don't remember where. And there were two groups of people. One group were white nationalists, as they call themselves now, and the other group weren't. And you've got two guys with megaphones standing a yard away from each other, screaming obscenities at each other. And it sort of, yep, that's where we've come to. And that the problem is the fervor. The problem is the fanaticism and the inability to sit down and talk about it. And in talking with people of different faiths, I have three friends who are theologians, and they're perfectly happy to take on my agnostic criticisms or questions about what they believe, and they answer to the best of their ability. I remember a situation where I was with two born-again Christians who I was working with many years ago, and a conversation started, and then one of them said to the other, you mustn't, I think it's something like contest with faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not allowed to do this. And we're having an interesting conversation about whether Jesus did or didn't historically exist and to what extent the Gospels contradict each other and this kind of thing, because that's the sort of person I am. And the discussion, that was the end of it. There was a third person in the room who was also a Christian. All four of us were dealing with cult groups. And the other person in the room said, it is sounding to me as if you are in a cult when this was put forward. So, it, you know, but yes, I think there's a tremendous change that is to do with authoritarianism. I think Ira's intelligent disobedience and teaching kids to assert themselves is a very important part of that. But that we are still working within systems which tend to be authoritarian. They tend to be, and then at the other end, we've got postmodernism. I became very interested in Alexander Dugin, one of Putin's chief advisors. And there's a little video of him saying, in the West, you have postmodernism, and that shows that your truth is not my truth. And it's sort of, no, gravity functions, whether you believe it or not. And this confusion, which many people seem to have. Stephen Jay Gould answered, you know, got into quite a bun fight with Richard Dawkins over Dawkins' pronouncements about religion. And he said, you've not understood. Science is one magisterium, which deals with quantities and the measurable. Faith is another magisterium, which deals with qualities and belief. And I think it was a point very well made. And is until we, you know, until we solve the hard problem of consciousness, until we understand what consciousness is, how we've got it and how it works, we won't be able to unite those two magisteria if we ever do come to understand that. And,
so I'm struggling to remember the exact words Harari uses, but there's a couple of things I'd want to bring in from my recent reading there.
Yeah, yeah.
So Doubting Thomas, the object of truth is important. So Harari talks about ethical judgment, which is like obey God or it's in the Bible. Hmm. Then there's a category, I've forgotten the name, but it's like... So here's some details of what you now must do because of that ethical judgment or edict. And then there's sort of practical consequences of that. But what he says is science can't do anything about the ethical judgment, which is, I think, what you're talking about as one of the realms. You know, that's just kind of deus ex machina. You know? It's designed, he would say, to organize human beings. It's a fiction. This deus is a fiction that allows large groups of human beings to cooperate in winning a war or whatever. Hmm. But what you can do is when in the second category, science may have a lot to say about exactly who did write the Bible. Hmm. And what were the context and history. He's a historian, you know, he's into, you know, as objective as a historian can be, finding facts that give pretty good ideas of when this book of the Bible was written and what the context was and why the writer was writing it then, because of this or that political aim that they had. And the second thing I want to say is quite different. Harari is describing, to summarize the two books, he's describing the human race as, and this is the most extreme thing, and he's asking us to question this. He's saying, is this right? But what he says is the human race is basically a passing phase for slow algorithm and data processing, which is already leading to the phase which will take over, which is what he calls the religion of dataism. That is, data and algorithms are already much superior to what humans can do. And what he says is consciousness doesn't seem to be needed for this extremely superior intelligence. If the algorithms work and can learn without consciousness, why do we bother trying to work it? It's just been a phase. We've needed to be conscious as human beings to do it. The outcome of that, again, I'm summarizing extremely briefly, and as I say, he's saying, is this what we want? The outcome of that is likely to be that we're going to be human beings, except for those few that may be in the driving seat and know how to drive this new total artificial intelligence, which will include new functions that it hasn't got yet. But already we hand over loads of our life through our smartphones and everything to artificial intelligence because it is much better than we are. What he says is, ordinary, most human beings are going to end up being treated like we treat chickens, right? Because artificial intelligence won't rate consciousness and feelings and wonderful experiences and awe and all these things. It'll just get on with the more important stuff, and it will know us better than we know ourselves. It already knows us. So for an example, which leads to one of the things I hope we'll talk about, is a device that might help people be protected from cults and diminishing cults. But what he says is so an example of this was there's already in operation a phone helpline where the computer can tell from the first phrase of the incoming caller, a human caller, they can tell whether this person's personality is extrovert, introvert, whether they want a nice, direct, straight, quick answer, or whether they're phoning and they want a long emotional chat. And the machine routes the caller to an appropriate human at the moment, but presumably eventually an artificial intelligence advisor. So the one who needs a chat will be routed to a chat person. One who needs a direct, straightforward answer will be routed to them. So here's an example of where in one sentence, the artificial intelligence can suss out a human being's state of mind and personality and what they want. And of course, we have now artificial intelligence is able to write the next chapter of your book in 3 seconds and you won't recognize it. To some people.
Yeah, a friend of mine is actually using, ChatGPT? And they're finding that it will do remarkable things. I'm hesitant. The first thing is we're talking about the singularity.
So am I.
Yeah. We're talking about the singularity, what's been called the singularity for a long time, which came out of Silicon Valley in California in the 80s. And this idea that eventually all the devices in the world will sync up and their power will be so much mightier than human beings that they'll just look after us. Now, I think H.G. Wells touched on this more than 100 years ago with the idea of the Morlocks and, you know, the separation of humanity into evil predators and prey. And I'm trying to remember the name of... There was a defecting voice, and this guy wrote several books, one of which I read, which was very interesting, saying why. And he's one of the creators of one of the significant things in computing. And he was saying, no, the singularity, this idea that we will kind of teleologically make God, not in our own image, and that it will then rule over us benignly, it is falsifiable. There are many reasons why this is probably not going to happen, and this is, I suppose, the essential question. We have to keep hold of artificial intelligence. Looking at the Cambridge Analytica aggregate IQ, the idea that Robert and Becca Mercer could pour this money in, buy all of the information from Facebook, which gave them what they call 5,000 data points, what I think of as pieces of information, on every adult in the United States, because whether you've been on Facebook or not, you've been mentioned. And so Brittany Kaiser, who sold Cambridge Analytica to Donald Trump, so she was a serious person, she broke away and started pointing out what was happening. And one of the things was that Facebook, by the time Cambridge Analytica bought their information, 40,000 corporations had already bought that information. And we get into tremendous issues of, you know, when you see how in the Brexit campaign, you could micro-target people. You could say, just send us your email address. And if you get the goals right for Saturday's match, and you've got like a 1 in 100 million chance of doing that, you'll win this great prize. We've got your email address. Now we're going to find out about you. And it was a rigged election. No two ways about it. Because this new power had come into the world where you could convince people by sending them the material that would convince them. You know, so you could find out exactly what their prejudices were. It reminds me of when Jimmy Carter was campaigning for president, and he does appear to be one of the few fairly reasonable human beings to have held that position. That not, you know, most of the people who've been top leaders in the world are actually pretty difficult people. I think Carter was fundamentally ethical, but he was caught on the stump that he would go from one town to the next, and his survey people would have looked at what the issues were in that place. And before the internet, it seemed safe to actually contradict himself from one town to the next to get the votes. And that that pressure and the short-termism of our political system, where it's always about first 2 years trying to make a difference, second 2 years trying to get re-elected, you know. The system as we have it doesn't work. One of the scary ideas that Harari is putting forward is that this will get rid of democracy. You know, the machines will know what's best for us. And I just think two things. One, the Terminator, and two, the Matrix. That these are thoughts that people have had and put on screen. And we do need to be, you know, what's happening in medicine with AI is phenomenal. The idea that, you know, as long as you've got a physician present, however, so that when all the data has been crunched and things gone, oh, you've got Whipple syndrome or some obscure thing that wouldn't necessarily have been recognized. It certainly wouldn't have been recognized by a general practitioner unless they'd seen it before. But that as an adjunct to human consciousness and within the realm of human ethics, this is a good thing. But what we've seen with Mark Zuckerberg and his like, it is the very deliberate misuse of these tools to oppress and enslave people, you know, to get, you know, and QAnon is that just the most perfect and bizarre example of this.
So I'm really pleased. In a sense, I raised this because I hoped you'd be able to come up with arguments against Harari. I've not had time to Google enough to find his critics. How do you get, given that we all know how unwittingly and also purposely people are bad actors, let's say, are using all the things that you described about the internet, Facebook, and Jimmy Carter, but using Facebook as your source. I think Harari is saying, since we don't, although we love this, first of all, he's saying we love this. We're more than happy. It's like a cultic process where the recruitment is going really, really well because, you know, we love iPhones. We love all the stuff that it does for us, the routes it finds, the this and the that, you know, paying for meals online, dashing through London with just your Visa card to get through the underground. So we love all that. We're fully on board. And even if we, you know, we'll be so love-bombed by the system that it may be quite hard to hold on to our consciousness and our the value of being slower than artificial intelligence, the value to us as chickens, for example. So, can you say a bit more about how are the good actors going to take over the levers of what it's obvious that people who want power and money and criminal advantage are going to be the most motivated to use these internet functions for. So how are we going to he's talking about believing in data as the ultimate god is a religion. He says that it's like all these other things that human beings have invented, fictions that were then very powerful. We are going to have a campaign, aren't we? So we're back to campaigning that will find a way to persuade the human race to use these artificial intelligence functions when they're serving us well, but watch out very much for the bad actors using them. So, but we needed a campaign to persuade a non-dataism religion to balance this direction that we are already heading in. How is that going to be done? How do you campaign for that?
I firstly take issue with Harari's use of the word religion. I think he's talking about belief systems, not religions.
Yes, he is.
And so that's of no great consequence. We understand what it is he's saying, and it is valid. I take issue with the concept that we are data processing units. The information age is where we live. I think that fails to take in the breadth of human experience. seriously. I think there are certain fundamental problems, and one of them is this left and right idea. That, you know, and it's a much more heated debate in the US than it is here, because you're a lefty or you're you know, neoconservative or what have you. And I see a problem that it seems to me the wrong way to assess things, that the idea that there is this line, and at one end you have, well, there's the left of center, and at the other end there's the right of center. I think that our political systems have always been more complicated than that. This last year, since I read it, been recommending David Graeber and David Wengrow's The Dawn of Everything. And they take Harari on directly, along with Jared Diamond and various other pundits, and say they don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what they're talking about historically. So, you know, and Harari is a historian, but he's not an archaeologist. He's a historian. And Wengrow is an archaeologist. Graeber was an anthropologist. And they provide this rich panoply of human experience. So, and get into detail, and they particularly criticize Harari for making many of his comparisons in Sapiens with apes and calling us apes. And while I'm absolutely willing to accept that we're primates, we are not apes. You know, those, and I did a hell of a lot of reading in the 80s about chimps, bonobos, and orangutans, and our relationship. Behaviorally, I'm a big fan of Franz de Waal's work in that area. But to show that these animals are much more developed than we've given them credit for, I mean, there was a thing reported a couple of weeks ago that shown chimpanzees signing to one another, 60% of people know what the signs mean. You know, they can work it out. So, yeah, there's a proto-language there, if you like.
But he's very clear that the difference is that all these other animals that are social do not have the capacity that he, I think, I would accept his core thesis, which is the thing that changed, and he describes the phases in history anyway, if not archaeology, that led...
Well, they're prehistory, aren't they?
Well, yes, prehistory, but that, you know, there's enough evidence, and he's hugely referenced. So, I know he refers to others to review his work and before it's published. So, he is being scientific more than many. But what he's saying is, none of these other animals have the capacity to have a fiction that's persuasive of large groups of their species in order to coordinate them and then to change it quite quickly. You could say bees and ants have a system, but there's no way that they can change their system. It's the same in all parts of the world. They can't change suddenly and have an election or something for a new queen bee. So, well, he's saying,
interesting you should say that, because bees are perhaps the only democratic animal on the planet that we know of so far, that we now know that they vote to move hive locations.
Okay, well, okay. So
they can make determinations as a group. And he's looking, he's a historian. He's not an entomologist. So there's another fundamental flaw in Sapiens, which is he's a modularist. He believes that we have acquired brain modules, which are inherited and passed down. There is no evidence to support that, and there's a great deal of evidence to go against it. It's where Scott Atran came up with his idea that religion was a module and you can't help it. You know, you've inherited it. There's no evidence for this. And in terms of how highly referenced he is or how peer-reviewed he is, there is always, you know, history should be scientifically done, but it isn't. And okay. In terms of references, my favorite example would be Adele Davis, who wrote many books about nutrition until she was sued by, I think, the parents of somebody who'd followed her advice and died. And it turned out in court that the references at the back of her book, she simply hired people to find any paper that was about vitamin C and put it in the references. So without checking the references, and I say Graeber and Wengrow, references, my God. And they show a consistency which is important. I think with Harari, there is this sense, you know, the Victorian sense of progress, that this step follows this step follows this step. It's inevitable. I don't think that patrician capitalism is inevitable. I don't think it's healthy. I don't think it's right to describe a world that has, you know, socialism or communism at one end and patrician capitalism at the other end. When we looked, say, to the Indus Valley civilization in what is now Pakistan, which for 700 years, we know, didn't fight wars, didn't have palaces or temples, and they somehow seem to have got along with each other for that time. There was a similar society in Ukraine, but unfortunately work on unearthing that has been suspended for the moment. But the very thing is in this idea of fictions, that word, you know, pulled me up straight away, that we can create fictions. I think that's not really a good way of looking at human society, politics, religion. They're all fictions. They're not fictions. They're imaginative, that thing which right. does separate us from the other animals, but where you are trying to find a way of understanding something, which I think religion is in its basis, and hopefully our understanding has developed a bit since the Bronze Age, when most of these religions came about. Imagination is not fiction. So there's a fundamental idea there that I also disagree with. And the problem is that if you build, and some of your layers are not in fact true, so modularism and evolution, for example, and not accepting that human beings can actually transform absolutely and utterly in a moment, that societies can suddenly change. You know, and this has happened in, you know, many disappeared societies. We've got no idea what happened to them. But we can change, you know, in August 1914, men queued to go and kill Germans. Nobody really knew why. When you look at it in terms of propaganda, it had been stirred up. You know, there were 400 novels that talked about German spies in British society. I don't think the Germans had printed anything like that. Erskine Childers' The Riddle of the Sands is the only one that's still in print. In 1911, the term the Great War was used for the first time, 3 years before it started. So within the society, there was this king and country, this belief in, you know, bashing the squareheads and the Huns, and people queued up. When the Iraq War, the second Iraq War, so-called, came about, 1 million people marched to say, not in my name. That notes the cultural transformation. And I think, to bring the point back, hopefully, that we have the capacity to look at this idea of artificial intelligence taking over and to think about it. When we were at Open Minds, I wrote a piece, I don't know if it's still on their website, called Little Sister is Listening to You. And because, you know, Alexa, Siri, Cortana, Google Assistant, what have you, there'd been a court case where I think the FBI had demanded a Siri recording or Alexa recording because it had recorded a murder. Now, good that they caught the murderer, but if you've got one of those systems in your house, everything's going back there. We know our emails go through another system. There's the Echelon phone system, which intelligence agencies have been using since the 1980s. So you've got this level of AI that's already functioning in our society. And what we're seeing is that it's not really making a positive difference. We're not really, we're not really progressing in our behavior towards one another, because governments now have access to this, and we still have the worst of cults, the intelligence agencies, these groups. I mean, I've been fascinated, I don't know if you've looked at it, by Bellingcat, and they've got all sorts of critics. But you've got this one guy who said, oh, I'm bored at work, I've got some time, I'll see if I can find out how this happened. And they, just using open source material, have actually provided more useful information than any of the intelligence agencies about what's happening in the world, about who the perpetrators are. You know, what was the plane that was shot down by the Russians, the MH15 or something? They sorted that out. And it's worth saying that when the Soviet Union collapsed, not one of the Western intelligence agencies predicted it. And you're going, so you've got hundreds of thousands of people believing in king and country or president and country doing this with all of these vast data resources. They're always, the military always held to be about 10 years ahead of the rest of us in terms of what they can do. And without human beings in that system, it reminds me, there was a science fiction story I read when I was a kid, and you've got these two systems and they've both got the same computers, these intergalactic warring, this war's been going on for centuries, and they find a guy who can add numbers up, and that's all gone, you know, that's all done for you, and they use him with the computer and defeat the enemy, because, you know, we are random number generators, if you like, we're able to do that. So I think putting humans back into the system, understanding the amount of surveillance we're under. I mean, in the UK, I think the Chinese are now vying with us, but we've for a long time had the largest amount of CCTV anywhere. And that can be very useful until you start getting into deep fakes and a corrupt system. I mean, there's been a TV thing about it recently. It was quite interesting, a drama thing. I think that I don't have solutions beyond the idea that we should be talking about these things, and we should be looking towards ethical treatment of others. So at the moment, we've got like the social justice movement, which you and I both have some apprehension about. And the idea that, you know, we've got to pay reparations for something or other that happened that you and I had nothing to do with. And, you know, the sense that if the wealth of the global north, as it's being called, does derive from the exploitation of the global south, as it's being called, though Australia is about the most exploitative place in the world at the moment, then there should be some balance. But that balance should probably be to make sure there's enough for everyone, rather than getting into a historical ledger and saying, you know, in the 1838 record of payments made to slave owners, we should trace down. There's a news broadcaster this week who's said that her family are going to give money to Grenada, I think it is, because they're in the 1838 book. They profited from slavery, and Trevelyan, I think, Laura Trevelyan. So for me, the thing is very much that I think we have the tools to solve the problem, and I think we have the intelligence to solve the problem, and we might have a little bit of artificial intelligence as well. I'm concerned about the kind of artificial intelligence agency, which is, you know, to which we are all being subjected. But to encourage debate, thought, rather than this shouting at each other on Twitter and, you know, and settling into that as a better development of our culture than Twitter.
Okay, so I mean, I'm as I say, I've only just read the Harari book, and I'm pleased to have somebody critiquing him and assembling that. And I think he is, in a sense, is in any case, he's very explicit at the end of the book. He's saying, "Is this what we want?" So I think he's part of creating the discussion. Okay. Yeah. So leave him aside, and you're sort of answering my question about campaigning, but I'm going to say it sounds like a good, you know, nice idea, but not an effective campaign yet, right? You were saying earlier, there's lots of change happening. That's great to hear. We're kind of agreeing that human beings are extremely brilliant at creating, imagining ideas, and creating an intersubjective world, which is like the, you know, that's in between subjective and reality. Mm-hmm. When you have an idea and relate it to somebody else, and you then start acting on it, you now have facts, which are your intersubjective action. So you now have a world that you can treat both subjectively and scientifically. So there is a science of campaigning, which is how to create such a structure and such a convincing. So we did it with smoking, you know, it took 40 years. Well, we did it with car seat belts, it took 30 years. So if can I say a bit more about sort of campaigning from my what I've learned as a previously amateur and now a slightly...
Please do.
So the thing that struck me is the people who are pulling bodies out downstream, to go back to that metaphor, are understandably absolutely transfixed by that downstream job, and somebody needs to do it while the system is as it is. It'd be inhuman not to. Nearly all of them can't break free of it. I think you said yourself, you know, you're encouraged to keep talking about, you know, Scientology downstream and how it's, you know, how it works. In order, you know, that's what people want from you, and you kind of can't break free to do
that's
what
how I'm saying
prevention. So that to me is a sort of example of what I experienced was really hard to break free of being at the front line of the system as it is, the downstream system, because it's so traumatic and desperately needy. And then people are trying to swim upstream, but the stream keeps carrying them down. So that's one of the dynamics that you kind of have to think outside the box. So the example I usually use is something like cholera, an epidemic of cholera. Of course, at the front line, you need medical teams doing what's quite a simple treatment, and you save lives. That's enough of an example. I was thinking of the Turkish earthquake, but leave that aside. But the prevention of cholera is nothing to do with medical teams or even medicine. Well, it is when you think about it, but the management of cholera is to have clean water supply. Clean hands and so on if there was an epidemic, but you'd prevent the whole thing. And vaccination, I suppose, would be another good example where we can get rid of across the world diseases. So you've got people who are at the front line who should be and are wanting to rid the world of this plague, but it's only 1 in 100 that breaks free to go upstream to sort of think, how do we prevent things? Now, the thing is, if you've got something that people know about, like car crashes, people know about car crashes, let's say, so they don't need to have any awareness campaign. You just go straight to preventing car crashes, right? Hmm. If you don't know about it, then there's a case for awareness raising as the first stage of your campaign. If there's a new disease, I would say in the case of cults and in the case of many family patterns, domestic violence, parental alienation, and so on, these are things that are so outside people's awareness that you may need to raise awareness, do what you, Steve Hassan, and others do, which is tell stories about this to try and prove. Of course, we know, and people in families and potentially in cults or having been in cults who haven't been in cults will say, oh, but that would never happen to me. So you're dealing with a wall of active denial and ignorance, when we also know that sometimes it's the most sensitive, intelligent people who are the best recruits for cults, who are the best people to become part of a bubble or a cult online and so on. So I have some sympathy for how do you campaign about cults. You're kind of stuck with trying to find a way to make people aware of them, make people aware of how they are done, and then hopefully educate people so they're ready to protect themselves from recruitment, which of course still doesn't get rid of cults. So you're still not preventing the disease, if you like. You're trying to protect people by inoculation from it. With families and two wishes, we do have a pretty easy job, because we're just reminding people about the importance of families for children especially, but throughout their lives. it's not necessarily easy or problem-free, but the people at your funeral are usually your family, people who in some measure have been attached to you, cared, loved you, and if necessary, hated you and argued with you and so on. So we have a quite easy campaign to remind people that what we're, you know, what they seem to have forgotten in the dominant culture. And the turning point, just to add a little anecdote there, I was comparing school refusal, which is a kind of a pattern that that's what it used to be called, where a child is anxious about going to school, stays with the parent, terrible anxiety, refusing to go to school, and what do you do about it? And then parent refusal, which is, again, you know, the question is, well, is there a reason for this panic and phobia, this refusal, or is it pure anxiety? Should we deal with it? So you're having to assess that with school refusal. You're having to assess it with parent refusal. The thing is, with school refusal, everybody accepts that everybody, including that parent and that child, needs, well, the child probably won't want to, but everybody else works hard, urgently, to make something come right. There are laws about school attendance, but you don't hardly need the laws because everybody wants their children to be educated until they're a young adult, at least. Mm. Parent refusal, there's a kind of switch off. Everybody says, oh, well, that's the child's choice, age 10, 12. So, you know, there's a completely different culture dominant, which is, you know, you try your damnedest to get school and child back, or education and child back together, but you don't bother at all if a child loses a loving parent and a whole side of the family. Yeah. So that's what struck me as the dominant culture has forgotten that even if something's going wrong with a parent, you need to assess it and make it safe and work with it. And so that's an example of how the two wishes aim is easy, but at least it resets the dominant culture so that people begin to say, hang on a sec, you can't get away with that. You need to work at it. With cults, it seems to me you're not nearly as privileged as that, because you kind of, first of all, have to make people aware of cults. It often affects adults being recruited if you're not born in. In a sense, the most you can achieve is identify. It's now very clear how it's identified. You know, you can see, list the ways in which people are recruited, the way people are then trapped, taken in and cut off. The most I can envisage thinking about it is, you know, inoculating, trying to educate so that people can spot it when it happens. And of course, Chalif says it's no good just teaching them like verbally, because it's far more powerful than that. You really have to get them to practice so that you know, here's teachers saying, now you must resist me. You must not do what I tell you. And teachers are nearly always saying, no, you must do what adults tell you. Mm-hmm. So he uses these powerful examples. The question of how you get rid of cults would require a major campaign to change the dominant culture. Not only should they be aware of cults, but everybody should be aware. So the moment anybody starts creating something that takes people in and cuts them off, somebody, a neighbor, a bystander needs to stop being a bystander and say, hang on a sec. It might be helpful if there are laws about it. You know, it's very difficult to envisage a real culture change that prevents cults happening. So that's kind of my application of a prevention campaigning model to cults. And I think you'd agree with me, that's kind of where cult prevention has got to, perhaps.
I think you have to make people alert to the signs, and those signs are pretty simple.
Yes.
But that does mean a change in behavior. So I mean, Sir Ken Robinson's work on education, or going back, say, to Matthew Lipman and Socrates for six-year-olds, and looking at education in a different way. I've got Lipman here, and he goes through a series of statements about which I'm going to add to our conversation because I think they're highly relevant. Yeah. He was a professor at Columbia, Ivy League University, professor in philosophy, who one day went, by the time I get them at 18, it's too late. You know, and so he looked at educating children from a very early age. And so he gives, it's a section called Restructuring Educational Practice, and he takes the given wisdom, which is education consists in the transmission of knowledge from those who know to those who don't know as a presumption of the existing system. And his response to that is education is the outcome of participation in a teacher-guided community of inquiry, among whose goals are the achievement of understanding and good judgment. The second is knowledge is about the world, and our knowledge of the world is unambiguous, unequivocal, and unmysterious, the standard school model. The response, students are stirred to think about the world when our knowledge of it is revealed to them to be ambiguous, equivocal, and mysterious. And that's even the case in physics, let alone, you know, in any other discipline, the hard science. The third is knowledge is distributed among disciplines that are non-overlapping and together are exhaustive of the world to be known. And the response is the disciplines in which inquiry occurs are assumed to be neither non-overlapping nor exhaustive. Hence, their relationships to their subject matters are quite problematic. And, you know, I've long felt that. Fourth is the teacher plays an authoritative role in the educational process, for only if teachers know can students learn what they know. The teacher's stance is fallibilistic, one that is ready to concede error rather than authoritative. And the fifth, the final point of the standard model, students acquire knowledge by absorbing information. It is data about specifics. An educated mind is a well-stocked mind. His response, and he has two to that, students are expected to be thoughtful and reflective and increasingly reasonable and judicious. And the focus of the educational process is not on the acquisition of information, but on the grasp of relationships within and among the subject matters under investigation. And I think he hits the nails on their heads along the way there, that we have to change that in our school system. And as Ken Robinson says, hundreds of schools around the world are doing that. You know,
That's good to hear, because the reason he's hitting those nails on the head is that the reports I hear elsewhere are that a lot of schools are caught up in quite the opposite culture of testing and exams and qualifications even worse kind of ideological, you know, they don't realize that some things are ideological. Instruction demands, in fact, higher education is well known for being in social sciences. There's a concern that I don't know how widely spread it is, but there's evidence that it's pretty widespread. It's now become a more ideological training ground rather than teaching people to think in exactly the way that Ken Robinson's talking about.
And I think, sorry to pick that point up, that's what we've seen in the cult field, that there are a tremendous number of pro-cult apologists, just so many of them, often hired by these groups, you know, professors, people with doctorates who are paid by Scientology or whoever to put forward some idea. And it is as if they've been blinkered in their education. I came head on against this. My son Samuel has a sleep disorder, and he could not attend school, and so we had to home educate him. And he'd been diagnosed with chronic fatigue and all of this. The upshot was that the 8 terms that he should have had to prepare for his exams, his GCSEs at 16, he only got 2 terms, and he didn't have. There's only one tutor at the school who was the computer guy, the IT guy, who actually helped him. The rest, although they had the obligation to help him, they didn't give him work, they didn't mark work, they didn't do anything. So we're left in the situation. He went online and found Khan Academy. And he came to me and he said, in biology lessons, when I say, why do we do that? They say, you'll find that out later. Just memorize it. Now, I had meetings certainly once a month for a couple of years with teachers over him and my youngest son, Dan. And the one phrase just kept coming up almost every meeting. They have to jump through the hoops. And eventually I found myself in a room with a deputy head, three teachers, and a child psychologist saying, and when do they get an education? Because, and I'll give a specific example, they're, you're meant to do Macbeth every, you know, for your exam every year. It's so boring for the poor teachers every bloody year. And so I went off and read James Shapiro's 1606, A Year in the Life of Lear and Macbeth. And wow, what an wow, Macbeth is just incredible. Why he wrote it, what's going on, it's amazing. And if you learn any of that and you're at school, you won't get any marks in the exam because you're not meant to watch the play, you're not meant to read the play, you're meant to read the sections, memorize the comments and go from there. So understanding that this play was written a few months after the 5th of November in 1605, the attempt to blow up the king and the whole of central London, in fact, that's kind of relevant that James had written Demonology, a book about magic, which he thoroughly believed in at that time. That he didn't like plays. He just imprisoned all of his only other play company. Any of this fascinating material, no marks for that. So we're no longer dealing with education. We're no longer dealing with creating curiosity and an inquiring mind. I'm very grateful now that I dropped out of school when I was 17. You know, people think I have some kind of university education. Folks, I don't. Because I do see those blinkers. I have met very few psychologists who know anything about psychology. I work with it. I see what happens to people in these conditions. Yeah. They have the theoretical construct. They've not got their hands dirty. I've done nothing but get my hands dirty.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've got more to say about that, but I'm watching time because I have to leave soon. But
we're going to have a rematch, yeah.
And if, okay. But just to say, I mean, I've always thought that university puts you straight into the specialism that you're learning. No, it's assumed that because you're bright, you know about problem solving, let's call it, life, and you don't. So you go straight into your specialism, and you may or may not bring in some of that ordinary common sense problem solving. So I agree with you about that. What I wanted to finish my bit today was to go back to artificial intelligence and leave you with this, if you haven't got immediate thoughts about it, is I've been looking at apps for my smartphone, and there is an app developed by Vodafone and somebody called Bright Sky. And it's kind of worthy, and it's for people to learn about, that is, they learn from the app about the signs of coercive control. I don't know how far it applies to cults, but it's more to do with families, I think. And what I was thinking is, well, hang on, if you've got telephone message machines that can already use one sentence to tell what kind of thing you want that day and what kind of person you are, and we have got lists that, you know, blindingly obvious features of people who are coercive and people who are victims and how it's done and hypnotism and so on. It surely is already possible and may already have be in place to have an app that is this may be unethical, but it's just I'm exploring this idea. You have in your iPhone an automatic app, just as you have for spotting hackers and so on to try and keep them out. And your app would produce a literal red flag on your screen when somebody who's messaging you or phoning you or in your choice of Facebook things to read or your blogs to read, if the app would be designed not to decide for you, but to just say to you, have you checked this resource, or have you realized that that person is trying to fool you or gaslight you? So I'm just saying that this is more than teaching the person how to do it. The app does it for you with its high intelligence and then lets you know that you should be a bit wary. How about that?
Yeah, it's probably a good idea. And to round up, I think there are two things. Firstly, that we need to, you know, since 2015, we've had coercive control as an aspect of law in this country. And despite the derision of various barristers about that at the time, it does seem to be helping. And that's the idea that you don't have to physically abuse somebody to be in control of them. And if that is true within intimate relationships, yeah, it is true elsewhere. And so in terms of restraining cults, one end is to teach people how to recognize the signs. You know, somebody is your best friend, you've never met them before. They think you're fantastic. And do you want to come to this weekend and what have you? No, it just isn't that way, I'm afraid. Friendship is something that has to be developed. The love at first sight model, it is not a safe way to live your life.
Instead of teaching you, the app will do it for you. That's what I'm trying to say. The app is already programmed to say, hang on a sec, this guy says you're friends and you haven't met him. Have you thought about that? You know, right at the start, before you get taken in and recruited, the app would say, hang on a sec.
App substitutes for human understanding. And if the human understanding is not there, then the app is useful. Okay. But if somebody recognizes these things, they see what love bombing is or what have you.
Yeah. I'm not denying that. Of course, both are good.
Yeah, absolutely. And while we are, you know, moving towards a situation where we have better comprehension of these techniques, it could be very useful. But I think we need to extend coercive control so that groups, you know, and some of the horrific things that I hear, it's very good to know that since the internet, droves of people are leaving these groups. The Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, are having a real collapse. The Jehovah's Witnesses, who number, you know, 7 million people or something, that lots of people, you know, even the Amish, the Mennonites, who don't have computers, of course, are finding out that things are different. And the other thing I'd mention is it's an appendix to my book, Opening Our Minds, called The Social Influence Model, written by Emeritus Professor Alan Shefflin.
Oh, yes.
And I think that this instrument, he applies it to the court. And you're saying, well, to what extent was this person influenced into doing what they did? So if we looked at, you know, Charles Manson's followers, we have this paradox that he controlled their minds and they're still in prison 50 more years later. So, yeah, where's the balance of responsibility? And I think the social influence model can then be applied outward. I think Alan, you know, did something quite wonderful with that. We're just about to put it up on Steve Hassan's website, because in going through a chapter that Stephen and Alan have written together, I've sort of, well, you've referred to his original paper on this, but Alan doesn't like his original paper on this. So at the moment, the only place it exists is in my book. So we need to put it in other places where people can see it. Anyway, I think we have had a very from my perception, we've had a very interesting conversation indeed. And let's get back together in a couple of months' time and see what else we've thought about.
Well, I do hope your listeners and watchers have also followed this, and that there are places they can kind of come back at us to ask questions if we then have a rematch.
Absolutely. We do have a comment section, and we do take note of what people say. We have 5,500 subscribers or something, so we're pretty tiny, but that we do have some quite intelligent people out there, and who often catch me out, I'm sad to say. Can't be helped. But yeah, so anybody who would like to ask a question or air a point of view, very interested in that. So thanks very much, Nick. It's been great.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me. Thank you to everybody who's been listening. Cheers.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much. Gravity functions, whether you believe it or not.